Well, I wonder what in this world scares you? What big beasts of the world fill you with fear? A few months ago, I watched a documentary on Netflix called The Social Dilemma. I don't know if you've seen it, but it's a documentary all about these big tech giants and how much they know about you. And it was very kind of striking and eye-opening. And they're called tech giants for a reason. Did you know, for example, that Facebook have 2.8 billion users? 2.8 billion, that's over 20% of the world's population are on Facebook. And if you're on Facebook, then they probably know quite a lot about you. They know what you like. They probably know what you've been up to. They might even know about that cheeky kebab you had for dinner last night. And they probably know where you are right now. They know all of that, about 2.8 billion people. I wonder how that makes you feel. Maybe you think of other beasts, maybe kind of oppressive nations in this world, maybe particularly living as Christians in China or North Korea, where the government kind of always seems to be watching and tracking you, one false move, one slip up, and that's it, prison, or maybe even death. I wonder how that makes you feel. And the book of Daniel, it was written at a time when Israel, God's chosen people, they're in exile in Babylon. And the people living there in exile, they would have been in fear as they were oppressed by the Babylonian people. They would have been really tempted to leave God's people behind and to run off and flee to another nation for safety. Look with me at verse 1. In the first year of Belshazzar, king of Babylon, Daniel had a dream. And visions passed through his mind as he was lying in bed. He wrote down the substance of his dream. So Daniel has this vision, and it happens during the reign of King Nebuchadnezzar's son, King Belshazzar. And I don't know what the scariest dream you've ever had is, but this is probably scarier. I mean, just look at some of the beasts described here. You've got a bear devouring its victims with ribs hanging out of his mouth. You've got a lion with a human mind and feet. You've got a leopard with four heads. And then look at me. Look with me at verse 15. How does Daniel feel about this? I, Daniel, was troubled in spirit, and the visions that passed through my mind disturbed me. And flick over to verse 28. I, Daniel, was deeply troubled by my thoughts, and my face turns pale. Daniel is disturbed by what he sees here. His face turns pale. He feels physically sick by what he's just witnessed. You can imagine him kind of coming around, waking up as a total mess, heart pounding, sweat dripping after this vision. And as we dig into this passage this morning, as we look at this vision, we're going to look at two aspects of this vision, and then we're going to look at the explanation that goes along with each. And the big question we're looking at is this. As these exiled people live in a world dominated by these massive beasts, as they live under the oppression and live in this fear, where is the hope for them? Where can they turn? And so the first thing that we see is this. Be realistic. The kingdoms of this world are terrifying. Be realistic. The kingdoms of this world are terrifying. Look with me at verses 2 and 3. Daniel said, "In my vision at night I looked, and there before me were the four winds of heaven churning up the great sea. Four great beasts, each different from the others, came up out of the sea." So there's these four winds, they churn up the sea, and it's absolute carnage. I mean, just imagine for a moment driving over to Winterton, maybe after the service today, you're probably not allowed to, but hey, and you're trying to calm the sea. Imagine crouching down to the side of the sea and using your hands to try and stop the waves. You wouldn't get very far, would you? The sea by nature, it's chaotic, it's untamable. All the people who have tragically lost their lives at sea have done so ultimately because it is unstoppable chaos. And that's the chaos here, only this is even on a bigger scale. See, since the fall in Genesis 3, the world has been on chaos, and that chaos, that rebellion against God, it's condensed here in the sea. And yet, what do we see? Rising up it are four different beasts. And these beasts are absolutely nightmare-inducing. It's nothing like we can even imagine. In fact, the English language can't even comprehend what's going on here. Just skim through these few verses, and you see that actually there's loads of likes that you see. It's all kind of weird, isn't it? It's nothing like we can even imagine. But although it seems really weird to us, actually for the people back then in Daniel's time, it wouldn't have been so strange. The Babylonians had a lot of gods, and they had statues of gods, and those gods were as abstract as what we see here in the vision. You only need to go to the British Museum to see that for yourself. So with that in mind, let's meet the first of our three creatures. Look with me at verse 4. The first was like a lion, had the wings of an eagle. I watched until its wings were torn off, and it was lifted from the ground so that it stood on 2 feet like a human being, and the mind of a human was given it. So the first is like this roaring lion, but it has eagle-like wings, and then they're torn off, and it has a human mind given to it, and it's standing on 2 feet like a human. So it isn't just some mutant, but actually someone who's able to reason and think, someone with intellect and real wisdom, but with that same kind of ferocity of a lion. And then we have another creature, verse 5. It's a bear. It's raised up on one of its sides. It's ready to pounce on its prey. It's overbearing. It's gruesome. You can imagine the blood dripping out of its mouth as it chews on the ribs of its victims. And it's told to get up and eat your fill of flesh. It's probably not one for the vegetarians among us. It's a brutal picture, isn't it? And then we have the third creature, a leopard-like creature, but with wings and four heads. It has power to dominate and rule. It has authority. It's like ever-present and ever-seeing. It follows and watches and waits and pounces. Maybe a bit like Facebook, I don't know. It's swift, it's quick. You can't run from it. It's always behind you. It's always chasing you. It's totally oppressive. And then if that isn't bad enough, we have this fourth beast. Look with me at verse 7. After that, in my vision at night, I looked, and there before me was a fourth beast, terrifying and frightening and very powerful. It had large iron teeth. It crushed and devoured its victims, and it trampled underfoot whatever was left. It was different from all the former beasts, and it had 10 horns. See, this one is outright described as terrifying and frightening. Well, considering the other beasts weren't exactly fairy tale creatures, this must have been something to behold, mustn't it? It's overwhelmingly powerful. I mean, just look at it. It's huge. It's like King Kong coming up out of the water, but it's worse. It has iron teeth, has bronze claws. It's ready to devour its victims. It's giant. It's trampling over everything that comes in its way. It's totally unstoppable. It has no mercy. There's no chance of fleeing from this thing if you face it. And just as the sea is a picture of chaos, horns here are a picture of power, and eyes are a picture of wisdom. And look, it has 10 horns. It's powerful. And look at verse 8. While I was thinking about the horns, there before me was another horn, a little one which came up among them, and three of the first ones were uprooted before it. And look at this horn. It has eyes like the eyes of a human being and a mouth that speaks boastfully. So it has eyes and it has horns. It's wise and clever and powerful. It's like an alpha beast. It's absolutely unstoppable. So we have these four beasts. One which is ferocious, but clever and tactical and sly. One which is bloodthirsty and ready to pounce and devour its victims. One which is totally oppressive and you cannot run from it. And the fourth, which is all of those things, but even bigger and more powerful and more giant and seems totally unstoppable. And I wonder how you feel reading this. But what's actually going on here? Well, if we skip over to verse 16, Daniel asks one of the angels standing there for an explanation. And the angel replies in verse 17. The four great beasts are four kings that will rise from the earth. So what we see in these beasts are four different kingdoms of the world. The lion-like beast is the Babylonian kingdom. And after that comes the second bear-like beast, which is the Median-Persian Empire. Now, how do we know this is the case? How do I know? I'm not just making this stuff up. Well, look at the bear. It has three ribs in its mouth. It's eaten up other kingdoms, Lydia, Egypt, and soon to be Babylon. And funnily enough, let's flick back actually to chapter 5. Daniel isn't in chronological order, so we're going to flick back to chapter 5. And look with me at the end of verse 30. Just verse 30, actually. That very night, Belshazzar, so the guy that's in charge when Daniel has this vision in chapter 7, king of the Babylonians, was slain. And who takes over? Darius the Mede took over the kingdom at the age of 62. So actually, this vision, it isn't fiction. It isn't some random dream which is the result of Daniel's cheese-eating rampage the night before. It isn't Land of the Wild Beasts 2.0. This is prophetic. This vision symbolizes real events which will actually happen. And as we see, some very soon after this vision happens, as we see in chapter 5. And then after the Persian Mede kingdom comes this third kingdom, the Greek Empire, led by Alexander the Great. His leopard-like kingdom, if you like, was known for its swift conquest of other kingdoms. And it has four heads because after Alexander the Great died, his kingdom was split into four sub-kingdoms. And then we have this fourth kingdom, and it receives special attention. Just look at verses 19 and 20. Daniel says, "Then I wanted to know the meaning of the fourth beast, which was different from all the others and most terrifying, with its iron teeth and bronze claws, the beast that crushed and devoured its victims and trampled underfoot whatever was left. I also wanted to know about the 10 horns on its head and about the other horn that came up, before which three of them fell, the horn that looked more imposing than the others and that had eyes and a mouth and that spoke boastfully." So this beast is even more powerful. It's proud. It speaks boastfully. This beast, this kingdom, its boss. And then read on to verse 21. "As I watched, this horn was raging war against the holy people and defeating them." So what's its aim? Who is it targeting? This beast is out to get God's people. It wages war and it makes total mincemeat out of them. It looks like God's people have no chance against this beast. No wonder the people in exile are thinking about cutting their losses and fleeing off to another nation. But this beast isn't actually just going for God's people. It's attempting world domination. Look at verse 23. He gave me this explanation. "The fourth beast is the fourth kingdom that will appear on the earth. It will be different from all the other kingdoms, and it will devour the whole earth, trampling it down and crushing it. The 10 horns are 10 kings who will come from this kingdom. After them, another king will arise, different from the early ones. He will subdue 3 kings. He will speak against the Most High and oppress his holy people and trying to change the set times and laws." So who is this beast? Who is this beast that's totally running riots? Well, this is the biggest kingdom of them all. It's the Roman Empire. And it completely takes over this part of the world as we know. At its peak, the Roman Empire covered 4.4 million square kilometers. It was huge. It was dominant. And we know that by AD 70, Jerusalem, the central place for God's people, the temple, had fallen. These people living under this beast, they're totally oppressed, and the Romans look in total control. And just imagine for a moment the exiles here hearing this with Daniel in Babylon. They think their situation cannot get any worse, and yet all of this is going to happen. And how does Daniel feel about this? Well, we've seen. He's overwhelmed. He's sick by this vision. This is horrifying stuff. And the original readers of this, who are reading this back in Jerusalem after exile, you know, everything's looking up for them. They're back in their own land. Yeah, things are going to get real dark real quick. I wonder what fears you're facing today. What beasts of the world terrify you? See, for us as Christians, as God's people, we're in a similar position to Daniel and the Israelites. We're in exile too. We live in this world of Babylon, if you like. We experience these different beasts, these great superpowers of the world, whether corporations or even pandemics, apparently. Our battle with sin, resisting the lies of the devil. These are real beasts that we each have to face day by day. You know, maybe we feel oppressed. Maybe we feel overwhelmed. Maybe we feel like it is all doom and gloom. What's the point of even dwelling on this? Maybe like Daniel, our faces are pale, we feel sick. What hope is there? Well, we've seen firstly to be realistic because the kingdoms of this world are terrifying. But the second thing is this, be encouraged. The kingdom destroyer has established an everlasting kingdom. The kingdom destroyer has established an everlasting kingdom. We have these four beasts, four kingdoms, and the fourth kingdom is absolutely running riot. But actually, look at the end of verse 25. The holy people will be delivered into his hands, this fourth kingdom, for a time, times, and half a time. This isn't going to be the way it's going to be forever. There's a time limit on all of this. Something is going to happen. But what? Well, flick back with me. I look at verse 9. As I looked, thrones were set in place, and the Ancient of Days took his seat. His clothing was white as snow. The hair of his head was white like wool. His throne was flaming with fire, and its wheels were ablaze. Thrones are going to be set in place. Someone is overruling all of this. And who? It's the Ancient of Days. And as Reg said earlier, it is a name to describe God which isn't used anywhere else in the Bible. He is over all of time and space. He is older than anything else. He is before everything else. We see his clothing is as white as snow. The hair on his head is like wool. He's holy. He's perfect. He's totally unstained and unblemished. His throne is flaming with fire. His wheels are ablaze. No one can get close to him. Verse 10, a river of fire flows coming out from before him. He's so great, he's so pure, he's so holy, he's so big. He is unapproachable. There are thousands of people before him, and yet notice that none of them can come close to him. There's this distance here between the holy between the people here and the Ancient of Days. There's this river of fire which separates them. And where are we? Well, look at the end of verse 10. We're in a courtroom. The Ancient of Days is sitting down to judge these beasts, these kingdoms. And he has a right to judge because, well, he's the Ancient of Days. He's before and over everything. And yet, the horn of this fourth beast looks to be running riot. He's still arrogantly and proudly boasting away. And maybe we might expect some great battle between this boastful beast and the Ancient of Days, but Dumbledore versus Voldemort, this is not. Look at verse 11. Then I continued to watch because of the boastful words the horn was speaking. I kept looking until the beast was slain and its body destroyed and its throne into the blazing fire. Oh, is that it? No great dramatic battle, no plot twist. I mean, it's a bit of an anticlimax, isn't it? The beast is judged and destroyed in an instant. Just like that, he's slain and he's thrown into the blazing fire. Flick over and look at verse 26. But the court will sit, and here's the fourth beast's power be taken away and completely destroyed forever. And what about the other beasts? Those other three beasts that we saw? Well, look at verse 12. The other beasts have been stripped of their authority, but are allowed to live for a period of time. They once looked big. They once looked mighty and powerful, and now they're merely shells of their former selves. The Ancient of Days, he has total authority. He has total power and control. No one can mess with him. These beasts, as monstrous and as oppressive as they once were, they're nothing compared to the Ancient of Days. They've caused so much chaos and havoc and oppression and fear, and they're destroyed in an instant. And we saw earlier that there was this river of fire which was flowing out of the Ancient of Days' presence in verse 10. No one can get near to him. He is just too holy and powerful and mighty. Yet look at verse 13. In my vision at night I looked, and there before me was one like a son of man coming with the clouds of heaven. And notice, he approached the Ancient of Days and was led into his presence. See, Daniel sees someone like the Son of Man arrive on the scene, and he comes in the clouds of heaven. He's coming with great majesty, and he's able to come into the presence of the Ancient of Days. Do you see that? And verse 14, he's given all authority and glory and power. Everyone is worshiping him as he builds an everlasting kingdom, one that won't be destroyed. See, these beasts, they thought they were boss. They thought they had control and power and dominion over this world, yet they are judged and they're slain in an instant. But this kingdom which the Son of Man establishes is absolutely other kingdom shattering. And how long will it last? Verse 14, it is everlasting. It will never pass away. It can never be destroyed. And for these people in exile, that must have been great news, mustn't it? You know, they look around and they see and they feel the effects of these monstrous beasts, these oppressive kingdoms. They're battered, they're bruised. Where's the hope? But there's a kingdom coming, which God is setting in place, and it will never be taken away or never taken over by another beast. It is everlasting. What great news to a people in exile such as these. But this isn't actually a new idea in the book of Daniel. If we go back to Daniel chapter 2, we see King Nebuchadnezzar has a dream, and it's about a statue. And look back at Daniel 2 with me. And look at verse 31. Your majesty, this is Daniel speaking, looked, and there before you stood a large statue, an enormous, dazzling statue, awesome in appearance. The head of the statue was made of pure gold, its chest and arms of silver, its belly and thighs of bronze, its legs of iron and its feet of iron and partly of baked clay. So this statue looks amazing, and these four different parts of the statue represent four kingdoms, and they're the same kingdoms we see in Daniel 7. But while you're watching verse 34, a rock was cut out, but not by human hands. It struck the statue on its feet of iron and clay and smashed them. Then the iron, the clay, the bronze, the silver, and the gold, they were all broken to pieces and became like chaff on a threshing floor in the summer. The wind swept them away without leaving a trace, but the rock that struck the statue became a huge mountain and filled the whole earth. See, this statue looked pretty good, didn't it? That was until a great big rock came and totally flattened it. And what does the rock represent? We'll look at chapter 2, verse 44. In the time of those kings, the God of heaven will set up a kingdom that will never be destroyed, nor will it be left to another people. It will crush all those kingdoms and bring them to an end, but it itself will endure forever. See, it's the same kingdom as we see here in chapter 7. This is the Son of Man's everlasting kingdom. And that begs the question, doesn't it? Who is this Son of Man? It is interesting. Like the Ancient of Days, this name is barely used anywhere else in the Bible. But turn over to Mark 14. I should have had this up on the screen, I'm sorry. But turn over to Mark 14. And where are we? Actually, funny enough, in verse 61 and 62, we're in another courtroom. And this time, though, it's the other way around. The high priest, who you could say is the horn of the beast of the kingdom of Rome, is on the judge's bench, and Jesus, the Son of God, is sitting in the defendant's box. And the high priest questions Jesus, "Are you really claiming to be the Son of God?" he asks. And Jesus replies, straight from Daniel 7, verse 62, "I am," said Jesus. "And you'll see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of the Mighty One and coming on the clouds of heaven." So who is the Son of Man? It's Jesus. And he is being given the authority, the glory, and the power of Daniel 7:14. He is establishing this everlasting kingdom, destroying kingdom. And it doesn't look that way if you read on Mark. It looks like Jesus' kingdom is destroyed as the Roman soldiers nail him to a cross. Like the horn, they talk boastfully as they think they're unstoppable. And yet we know the rest of the story, don't we? 3 days later, Jesus, the Son of Man, rose from the dead. And in doing so, he establishes his everlasting, never-ending, undestroyable kingdom. We'll flip back to Daniel 7 and look at verse 27. Then the sovereignty, power, and greatness of all the kingdoms under heaven will be handed over to his holy people of the Most High. His kingdom will be an everlasting kingdom, and all rulers will worship and obey him. So these kingdoms, they look great, they look powerful, but what will happen to them? Well, they'll be given, but to who? Well, notice it's not the Ancient of Days they're given to. It's not Jesus, the Son of Man, but actually his holy people, part of his kingdom. Isn't that striking? They're not even giving over to the destroyer, but to those in his kingdom. See, these kingdoms are nothing in comparison to the kingdom which the Son of Man is establishing. Everyone will know where he sits in the pecking order of the universe. And what will they do? They can only bow down and worship him. And so for these people in exile, this is great hope, isn't it? It's realistic. Yes, the kingdoms they're up against may look like they're running riots. It will be tempting to leave God's people and to seek solace in another nation. It will be tempting to side with the beasts, as it were. But ultimately, what is going to happen to those kingdoms? They'll be utterly destroyed. See, for Daniel, for the people in exile, for the original readers in Jerusalem, and for us here today, it's all about this eternal perspective. Things might look bleak. Life might be tough. And we know that well, don't we? We face so many trials and challenges. We mourn and hurt. We're frustrated and fed up. But there's hope. There's a real, certain hope. There is something far better coming. Another kingdom which has been established through Jesus, the Son of Man, and it is everlasting. But this isn't just a message for God's people there in exile. See, Daniel chapter 1 and then chapters 8 to 12, they're written in Hebrew, a lot of the Old Testament. But chapters 2 to 7, so including the statue that we read in chapter 2, and this passage here in chapter 7, they're written in Aramaic. Now, why? Well, actually, because this is a language the rest of the world at the time could understand, because it is a message the rest of the world needed to hear. The world needs to know that the kingdoms of this world are going to come to an end. The world needs to hear that there is another kingdom coming and it's being established, which is eternal. People need to hear. People need to believe to be part of his everlasting kingdom. And actually, it's no different now, is it? There's still time for people to come. There's still time for people to hear, to be part of this everlasting kingdom. And it's a challenge for us, isn't it? About how we warn people about this everlasting kingdom. And yet, despite this hope, look at how the chapter ends. Chapter 7, verse 28. This is the end of the matter. And I, Daniel, was rejoicing in the wonderful hope of this eternal kingdom, and I felt pretty great. That isn't what it says, is it? No. I, Daniel, was deeply troubled by my thoughts and my face turned pale, but I kept the matter to myself. You would have thought Daniel would have been off rejoicing, and yet his face turns pale and he keeps the matter to himself. Why? Well, it's true. A great everlasting kingdom is coming, but for Daniel, for the people in exile, it hasn't happened yet. These beasts are still out there, and Daniel still has to face them. The world Daniel lives in is still fear-inducing. And the beasts are still at large, and they're still in charge. They're still causing chaos and havoc. The world she lives in is still scary, and that is encouraging, isn't it? You know, people so often paint a picture of being a Christian as being all rosy and lovely and easy, and that couldn't be further from the truth. We're up against hideous, monstrous beasts. We're under oppressive kingdoms, and it's tough living in a world full of such pain and frustration and persecution and hardship and suffering and grief. And yet, we have a hope, don't we? What in this world are you afraid of? What fills you with fear? There's so much to be afraid of in this world. There are beasts which look totally dominant, completely unstoppable. But a kingdom has been established by the Son of Man, Jesus Christ, who loved us so much that he died so that we might enter into his kingdom of rest and security, and it will never end. I wonder, if you're part of that kingdom, is that your daily hope as you live in this world of beasts? See, other kingdoms come and go. Beasts devour beasts, and ultimately they are judged and slain. And those kingdoms will be flattened by the great rock of Jesus' everlasting kingdom. The big question, though, is this: which kingdom are you a part of? Let's pray. Lord, thank you for your everlasting kingdom. Thank you that through Jesus, through what he's accomplished for us, we can be part of it. That we can have this eternal perspective, that we can have this hope day by day as we face the beasts of this world. I pray that you would help us to have this right perspective as we go into this, into each and every day. Help us as we face these beasts to know that there is a better, everlasting kingdom, that it's been established and that we are part of it. In Jesus' name we thank you. Amen.